Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we talk about two fascinating marine species in the waters surrounding the Cape and Islands. Later in the hour, we focus on sea turtles and the new tagging techniques researchers are using to learn more about their distribution and behavior. But first, we talk sharks, a species that isn't top of mind for most of us during the month of December. But we knew this would be a perfect time of year to catch up with Greg Scommel. He's a biologist and shark expert at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries, because during the warmer months, he's in the water tagging white sharks. Greg, welcome back. Always good to see you.
Hi, Mindy. It's great to be here.
So tell us about how long you've been studying sharks and what got you started on this path.
Wow. Now I'm getting old. So it's I started back in the mid-80s studying sharks as part of my master's program at the University of Rhode Island. I worked for the National Marine Fisheries Service Lab in Narragansett, Rhode Island. And I came over to the state of Massachusetts in 1987 and started doing shark research for that state agency. And a lot of it was focused on a variety of other species, you know, not the white shark. And the white shark research really didn't kick off. Even though we dabbled in white sharks based on tissue samples we would collect from dead specimens, we really didn't start our tagging work until 2009.
But you, as a kid, didn't you had a fascination with sharks in general, didn't you?
I never outgrew that fascination. You know, dinosaurs and sharks are pretty popular among kids. Yeah. And for me, sharks always stayed as in my mind as something I wanted to work on. And I fell in love with the ocean at an early age. And so I got really lucky, you know.
Technology to aid in your research has really evolved since you first started your career. And we're going to talk about some of that latest technology in a moment. But describe how shark research was conducted when you first started.
Oh, a lot of our early work. I mean, I cut my teeth on, if you will, on studying dead specimens. You know, most of what we learned about sharks came from, you know, specimens that were sampled that we actively went out and sampled or were brought to us by fishermen. And so much of what we were doing, learning about the natural history, the physiology of these animals are coming from dead animals and tissues we had taken from dead animals. So my early years, 1983, 84, 85, I went to a lot of fishing tournaments. I went to fish houses and markets, and I would sample dead sharks and take tissues to learn about age and growth, reproduction, feeding ecology. Mm. But that all that has changed to some extent.
Yeah. Our focus locally is often on white sharks, but they aren't the only shark species that we have in our waters, right? So what are some of the other common species and what are some of the uncommon sharks that you've spotted over the years?
Well, there's at least a dozen or so species that visit our coastal and offshore waters in the summertime. Almost all of them are seasonal. And so we have the smaller inshore species. Most fishermen are very familiar with smooth dogfish, spiny dogfish. But we also get some of the requiem sharks, which include sandbar sharks and duskies, you know. And then there's the offshore species, which include blues and short fin makos, common threshers. The iconic basking shark is a visitor here. And much of the work we did early on was focused on these other species and how Massachusetts coastal waters plays a role in their natural history.
A large part of your white shark research is tagging, right? So how long have you been tagging with this latest tech? Tell us about this latest technology, because it's really improved since you first started, right, tagging?
Yeah, I mean, over the course of my career, it's been absolutely amazing. We've gone from, you know, when I started, we didn't have cell phones. We barely had desktop computers. I'm aging myself again.
Neither did I. I had a typewriter. Yeah. I'm right up there with you.
Yeah. And now we're literally strapping computers to sharks. And the latest technology we're using is to study their behavior. And we've coupled that with acoustic technology. So we're using a variety of tags. The most sophisticated has a camera system built into it. And we're actually getting video from those cameras that are strapped to the sharks for a couple of days. Also have what's referred to as sensors, accelerometry sensors that give us a gauge of how that animal is behaving every second. So these are really complex, sophisticated tags, and we couple that with acoustic tags, which emit very high-frequency sounds that are picked up by an array of acoustic receivers throughout Massachusetts. And that's used for a variety of species, not just white sharks, but as Kara will talk about, turtles as well.
Describe the process of getting a tag onto the shark? How do you find the sharks to tag? And once you find the shark, how do you determine it's a shark you want to tag?
Well, you know, we tend to focus on me, unfortunately, but it's a team effort. And it has multiple components. It starts with a spotter pilot in the air who locates the shark in shallow waters off the east side of Cape Cod, the outer Cape. And then I've got a captain driving a boat, John King. So Wayne Davis is our spotter pilot. John King is the captain of the boat of the Aleutian Dream. Megan Winton is on board collecting data all the time. She's a grad student at SMAST and a conservancy biologist. And then I'm out on the pulpit of the boat. And what we're trying to do is use the least invasive technique possible to place those tags on free-swimming fish. So we're not trying to capture them or handle them in any way. We don't want to modify the behavior of the sharks by tagging it. And so we literally are sneaking up on the shark while it's in shallow water. And then being out on the pulpit of the boat, I'm able to place that tag at the base of the dorsal fin using a small intramuscular dart, which is a standard tagging technique. And that way the shark typically just keeps swimming and behaving normally, and we're able to study normal behavior versus putting any kind of stress on the animal.
Do they feel it at all? I mean, is it just like a little, do you know?
it's hard to tell. Yeah. You know, some sharks completely ignore it. Others are kind of freaked out by the event. You know, it's almost a startle response, like, who would dare touch me, kind of a reaction.
Yeah.
But, you know, most of them barely move when I place the tag.
That's amazing. So I know this is probably a silly question, but how do you determine if the shark is male or female?
Well,
is it easy to determine or is it tough?
No, it's really easy. Okay. The one good thing about sharks and their relatives, as opposed to other kinds of fishes, bony fishes, is it's really easy to tell males from females. Males have modified pelvic fins that are called claspers, which are used in reproduction, and they're very conspicuous. They look like cigars down near the shark's pelvic fins. And the first thing we do when approaching any shark, we first listen to see if it's previously tagged, but I also capture GoPro footage of that shark by just attaching a small camera to a pole and getting video so we can determine not only if that shark is male or female, but if it's some shark we know based on previous markings, coloration, scarring patterns.
How do you use the underwater footage of the sharks that you capture with the GoPro? I mean, other than just then, do you use it later for anything else?
It's labor intensive and doing any kind of video analysis. And I have to thank my colleagues at the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy because they pour over thousands of hours of video to generate a catalog of individual sharks. And they've done a spectacular job over the last 2 years generating a catalog of well over 400 individuals based on the video captured by those GoPros.
Do they learn anything other than the identity of the shark? Does it tell you anything about their behavior when you have this video?
Yeah, we're trying to learn as much as we can from it. Particularly scarring patterns could be interesting. You know, the scars on females versus males, you know, adults, juveniles, you know, relative size of the claspers relative to the body. So we can determine perhaps if it's a mature male versus an immature male. So we can pull all kinds of little, you know, chunks of information from the video footage.
What is the scarring from?
That's a great question. You know, typically, when males mate with females, they hold on to the female because internal fertilization is what's going on. And they hold on to the female by using their mouths. And that can create massive scars. So we're trying to determine whether it's just females, but we're also seeing scars and injuries from other sharks on males. Yeah. You know, and we also see injuries caused by seals. You know, attack and kill a seal, it will fight back.
How many individual sharks have you been able to identify? You said there was 400 or something in the last couple of years, but you've identified a lot more than that, haven't you?
No, I mean, using the cataloging system, the conservancy folks have come up with almost 500 individuals.
Wow.
Now, we have tagged over 300 of those individuals. Using a variety of technologies or the combination of technologies.
Yeah, there's video of you on the pulpit of the tagging boat, right, when the shark leapt out of the water and lunged at you at the pulpit. What was going through your mind in that moment?
You know, it was a split second of my life.
Yeah.
But the video played so much and went viral that, you know, I kept seeing it over and over from the perspective of somebody watching the event and not experiencing it. I looked down straight into the mouth, the maw of that shark with its jaws wide open. And it, like I said, it was a split second, but, you know, I still have, you know, all kinds of emotions when I think of it, you know.
Yeah.
Luckily, the shark didn't come that high out of the water, and I'm protected by the pulpit of the boat. But, you know, I'm more so thinking about what was it doing?
Yeah.
You know, what's in the mind of that shark?
That's what I was going to say. I mean, we don't really know, right? But, I mean, that's unusual, isn't it? You don't usually have them leaping out of the water like that.
Very rare. Very rare. And I guess my working hypothesis is that shark saw my image. It was in hunting mode. It was very, very murky water. Relatively shallow water, and it saw my image at the surface and struck at that image. And the momentum of the shark carried it out of the water. Luckily, not too high.
Yeah. You mentioned it's in shallow water. How shallow do these? How close do these sharks get in that shallow water to shore?
Mindy, one of the things I like to tell folks, I think it's important for them to know, is it's not so much proximity to shore as it is water depth. So if you are literally just a few feet from the shoreline, but you've got 8 to 10 feet of water there, there could be a shark that close.
Mm-hmm.
And there are parts of the Cape where the depth drops off dramatically that close to shore. So I ask folks to become familiar with where they're going to recreate and what they're going to be doing relative to the water depth. Because these sharks, as long as they can approach the shoreline, and that's where the seals are piled up, and the seals are fully aware of the presence of these sharks come summer, and they're going to stay as close to shore as possible, and the sharks have them pinned against the shore. But in some cases, they're going to come as close as they possibly can to get to those seals.
I actually have a friend who lives in Wellfleet who was at the beach. This was a couple years ago, where she said, you know, the shark was chasing a seal. The seal actually came up onto the beach, and so did the shark, grabbed the seal, and then the shark kind of like went back into the water. And you thought, wow, how is that even possible? But she said, yeah, it was a pretty gruesome thing to see. But that's, I guess, they're, you know.
That says it all.
I mean, they can get really close, right?
There's a bit of a learning curve for each individual shark. And so they adapt individual behaviors, which makes it hard for us to generalize relative to the predatory strategies of these animals. But some will come that close, and we've seen them actually beach on sandbars and then have to struggle to get off in an attempt to go after a seal.
Yeah, say in that hunter mode, right? It's
yes.
Like they're going
it is.
For it.
It's that predatory mode they get in, and that's what I'm most fearful of relative to human safety.
Yeah. We're talking about sharks with Greg Skolmel. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking sharks with Greg Skolmel. He's a biologist and shark expert at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, you have a question or story, 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you've learned a lot about sharks over the years. And I don't know if you know the answer to this question. Are they intelligent? How intelligent are they?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind it's a fish.
Right.
You know, sharks are fish. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, their brain size is relative to body size, is actually quite large compared to other species of fish. But most of that brain is committed towards sensory perception. Mm-hmm. You know, the variety of senses that they have, including everything from smell to sight to even electrosensory perception. And so, you know, they do have to learn to successfully attack and kill seals. And so there's a bit of a strategy adaptation that has to happen there. And let's face it, our sharks come back every year. So they swim thousands of kilometers away. And so there is some intelligence that goes into that, mostly instinctive. But you know, they're not going to work for NASA any day soon.
What about personality? Do they have I mean, you know, sometimes you see that in animals, right? Different animals have personalities. Do you see that in sharks?
Well, there's great debate over, you know, how do we quantify and characterize personalities in animals. But and maybe we can't call it a personality,
right?
Because we think so anthropogenically, but The truth is that we see such individual distinction between these sharks. You know, there's a lot of what we call intraspecific variation in behavior that almost gives you the sense of personality. You know, one shark may, you know, want to come in closest to the beach at night, and another one would only do it during the day. You know, and we see remarkable differences in where they spend their time. So there is almost this sense of personality among these individuals, which of course complicates our ability to generalize.
Now, with that encounter you had with the shark leaping out of the water at the pulpit, have you had any other sort of you know, concerning moments in your research years?
Well, not as much with white sharks. You know, I've been in the water with a lot of white sharks in other parts of the world, and we did. I did dive with a white shark back in 2010 that was feeding on a whale carcass about 15 miles east of the Cape. And we were in a cage, and the shark got caught on top of the cage and started smashing the cage apart. So that was probably my other high anxiety moment with white sharks, and where I wasn't sure whether, you know, I would end up, you know, either on the bottom or in the water with this big animal.
Oh, boy.
But fortunately, it became disentangled.
How often do you get to go into the water?
Well, I used to dive all the time with sharks in New England, and I don't do it so much anymore, largely because of time. I don't have a lot of it, and most of our work is conducted from the boat. But I still travel to other parts of the world, and I love to go diving with a variety of species of sharks. If I don't do that at least once a year, you know, then I start to dry out.
Do you have a favorite species?
Yeah, I'm a bit fickle when it comes to, it depends on what, like when I was doing my master's degree back in the 80s, blue shark was my favorite species because I was working on blue sharks, you know. But the more I encounter over the years, I mean, great hammerheads, we've been doing work on with UMass Amherst and students there and professors were working on hammerheads. I love those animals. They're incredibly unique, you know.
Very different looking. Yeah.
You know, the next week I might see a bull shark and say, "No, that's my favorite." Yeah. So it changes.
What about the lemon shark?
Oh, beautiful animals.
Yeah. It's funny. My grandson said the lemon shark is a friendly shark, and I went, "What? There's a friendly shark?" And it turns out they are pretty friendly, if you want to term it that way, right? They're not going to bother you if you're in the water with them.
Yeah, we tend to characterize as sharks as mean animals and turtles as happy, wonderful animals. And that's just us inserting our opinions. And the truth of the matter is, you know, because an animal, you know, shows aggression when it has to feed, you know, that's called just predation. And it's not really anger.
You talked about where you place the tag. And I imagine that's got to be tough. You're up there and you're trying to get the tag in a particular position. Does it matter that much if it gets into another spot? Or, I mean, talk about the positioning of the tag, why that's important.
It's very important. I mean, again, it goes back to not wanting to impact the behavior of that animal post-tagging. And so, you know, back in the middle of the 20th century, sharks were started being tagged using this method, a small dart at the base of the dorsal fin, which would be, I guess, the only equivalent aspect of it would be maybe piercing our ear, you know? And so we try to target that area. We don't want to go into any vulnerable spot on the animal. We don't want it to bleed excessively. So, you know, if I can't hit that spot, then I won't place the tag.
You wait and try again. Yeah. So I imagine that tags come off, right? So what are some of the issues you have? You know, how often are you getting data from the tagged animals, and what kind of data are you receiving?
Yeah, it depends on which aspect of the study we're working on. We're really intensively looking at fine scale behavior right now. And so these camera tag systems are designed to stay on for 2 or 3 days, and they've all worked very, very well. They come off after 2 or 3 days, and we have literally a million data points. The acoustic tags, however, are designed to stay on hopefully for as much as a decade.
Oh,
and
wow.
So we can get years and years of data from an individual shark. And we've had great success. We've had at least 6-7 years of retention, which is as long as these tags have actually been out. We do get some level of tag shedding. You know, it's very clear to us that in some cases tags are bitten off by other sharks. That happens. But because we've been able to catalog these animals, we can document those shedding rates, which seem to be very low right now.
Yeah. We talk about sharks moving in and out of our area, right? And I think you've learned that maybe they're here a little more, a little longer than maybe we once thought, right? So what is a, you know, typical, for white sharks anyway, when are they in our waters and when do they leave?
Well, there's a very distinct seasonality, and it's like a bell-shaped curve, Mindy, in the sense that, you know, they start to trickle in mid to late May with really just a couple of animals, and then it's, you know, slowly ramps up in June, but not a lot. A lot depends on water temperature. Mm-hmm. If we have a nice warm spring, we'll start seeing sharks a little bit earlier. But July is really the month of transition where we get the bulk of the animals, the peak months being August, September, and October. And I think a lot of us were thinking, well, when the waters start to cool off and the kids go back to school and the beach, lifeguards go home, the sharks are not here. And that's not the case. They'll be here into November. But then we'll start getting those wonderful New England nor'easters, and that'll cool water temperatures off, and the sharks will start to leave by the second week in November. Mm. And by mid-December, you know, they're all gone.
They're gone. So do they eat different things when they're up north versus down south, or is their diet pretty much the same?
No, it definitely changes. You know, this is an amazing animal in terms of its plasticity. So it comes to New England to feast on seals and other abundant sea life. You know, we've documented them eating, you know, spiny dogfish. Mm-hmm. You know, occasionally I bet they bite a turtle or two. But when they go down south, you know, we don't have those robust seal populations at all. So scavenging whale carcasses is important for them year round. But also dolphins, porpoises are in their diet as they move mm-hmm. south into those areas where those animals are very abundant. And then other sharks and other species of fish. So they have a fairly broad diet, but mm-hmm. they want to target those seals when they're up here.
And does their prey preference have anything to do with their size? You know, if it's a younger, smaller shark, does it focus on a fish rather than a seal or something like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's this dietary shift that occurs, and it really just means they start to add bigger items to their diet as they get larger, you know, as they get after they go through puberty, if you will. They have the capacity to attack and kill big prey, which includes seals and other parts of the world, sea lions. Yeah. And so younger sharks will feed on, you know, squid to fish species, bottom fish species. But as they get bigger, say in excess of 9 feet, 10 feet long, they have the capacity to attack and kill, yeah. you know, seals.
How long can they get? What's the biggest that you've seen of a white shark?
Well, I was fortunate to be diving off Mexico a few years ago, and I saw a shark that was about 20 feet long.
Wow.
But here, you know, our average size is 12, 13 feet. We see a lot of 9-footers, but the biggest we've ever tagged was about an 18-foot female named Curly.
Wow. How do you come up with the names?
Well, you know, I don't typically name many of them myself. In some cases, sponsors at the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy mm-hmm. can have a shark named after whoever they want.
Yeah.
We will also use names. You know, the catalogers over at the Conservancy will use a descriptive name like Bent Fin or oh, yeah. Scarface yeah. or something to that extent that helps us remember who that shark is based on characteristics.
Yeah, it's hard to remember all the numbers, right?
Oh, I can't. Yeah.
So we tend to think that white sharks are where the seals are, right? But are you finding them in other places like, you know, Buzzards Bay, Vineyard Sound, Nantucket Sound, with any kind of frequency?
Well, one of the things we've tried to do over the years is expand our acoustic receiver array so we can get a relative sense of where they are in Massachusetts. And by far the dominant area is the Outer Cape. We'll also see them on the eastern side of Cape Cod Bay. But they're found almost everywhere in Massachusetts waters to some extent. You know, they mm-hmm. they will move north and south into the Gulf of Maine fairly frequently. A shark could be on Cape Cod one day up into off the coast of Maine a couple days later and then come back to the Cape. But places like Buzzards Bay, Nantucket Sound, Vineyard Sound are fairly devoid of sharks. They will move into Nantucket Sound, Vineyard Sound late in the season, like this time of year, you know, November, December, as they're departing. But we have very few detections, if any, in Buzzards Bay.
Interesting. How has our understanding of shark distribution, population size, and behavior changed since you started tagging and tracking white sharks?
Well, we've been able, and again, you know, funding sources like the Conservancy have enabled this, you know, we've been able to expand our technologies to better monitor presence, absence, and that's the latest and greatest tools, you know, the acoustic tags, and over multiple years, so we can get a relative sense over time of what individuals are doing, but also what the population is doing throughout Massachusetts waters. Is it expanding its habitat, or is it using the same areas over and over again? And we've been working collaboratively with the other states in New England through the New England White Shark Research Consortium, you know, Rhode Island, Maine, to get a sense of what these sharks are doing as they approach Massachusetts and how far they go into the Gulf of Maine, in particular in response to the fatal attack of 2020 mm-hmm. off the coast of Maine, which I think admittedly blindsided many of us.
Yeah. In the course of your research, have you seen any notable changes in white shark behavior or distribution? I'm thinking you mentioned when we weren't on the air about stranding. You used to find them stranded, and we don't see that anymore.
That was really interesting. You know, and we started this in 2009, 2010, 11, 12. You'd see one or two sharks a year strand. Seemingly in an attempt to get to seals close to the beach. We don't see that much, if ever, at all now, you know, strandings of white sharks. And I don't know whether, you know, that's why we hypothesize that there's a bit of a learning curve when it comes to attacking seals in the challenging dynamic environment of the Outer Cape. And they're figuring it out slowly, and they don't take the risks that they used to.
What are some of the big questions that remain about their behavior or life cycle that you're hoping to learn?
Well, there's a lot, you know, and even in other parts of the world where they've been studying sharks for multiple decades, that some of the most basic questions about natural history, including reproductive biology, we just don't have answers to them. And so the same is true here in the Atlantic. So we're you know, working with a number of collaborators trying to tease away at answering some of these questions about natural history. But also we're really intensively looking at this predatory behavior off the Cape so that we could provide information that would enhance public safety. You know, what are these sharks doing, not from day to day, but really from minute to minute or even second to second, that will give us patterns in behavior that will allow us to forecast those times or locations where people might be more at risk or less.
Thankfully, we had a season with no human white shark interactions. But talk about the collaborations amongst towns, the National Seashore, and shark researchers to educate the public about sharks in our waters.
Really critically important, and a real credit to the Conservancy, but to the towns themselves and the Park Service. I mean, one of the first initiatives back in 2010 was getting together with towns and getting word out there about the presence of, you know, predatory sharks in nearshore areas. And the towns have really embraced that. The Park Service has been fantastic with that. You know, get the signage out there, get the information out there any way we can. And the Conservancy, of course, is fantastic at doing this through the shark centers and other vectors that they have. Working with the media, you know, letting folks know about these animals and what we're learning at the same time.
Right.
You know, we're trying to be an open book relative to our research. But, you know, it's difficult because research happens relatively slowly.
After a tragedy involving a shark, there are all sorts of ideas that come up. I remember discussions about deploying nets a few hundred feet offshore to keep sharks out of swimming areas, or buoys that would, you know, emit acoustic waves at a frequency that might keep sharks away. Aside from staying out of the water, are there any options to prevent human-shark interactions? Are there suggestions you give to folks?
Well, there's no, you know, we always say it, there's no silver bullet. You know, there's no one methodology or technology that's going to be effective 100% of the time. But there are early warning systems. There's some promise using drone technology, for example, to detect the presence of these animals near swimming areas. That's effective or can be effective, not 100% of the time. And there's other technologies that are being explored. I think the idea of setting up barrier systems in such a dynamic environment like the Outer Cape is not likely to succeed. But we're very open-minded to testing and working with other researchers and technological companies who want to test some of these things.
There are apps that allow people to track the locations of tag sharks, but the data isn't real time, right? It shouldn't be used to determine if an area is safe for swimming because that's just the tagged sharks and there could be other sharks.
A very good point, Mindy. Yeah. You know, we don't know what proportion of sharks are actually tagged versus untagged, but realize apps like Sharktivity will tell you where sharks have been detected. We did, over the last 2 years, deploy real-time acoustic receiving systems that would send notifications immediately in real time to Sharktivity as well as to public safety officials. But again, and that seems to be working quite well in terms of notifications. However, falling back on that caveat that we have not tagged all these sharks. So yeah. Because we haven't heard from a shark doesn't mean there isn't one there.
Right. If money and technological limitations weren't an impediment, what kind of tag or research tool would you design to answer some of the important questions that you want answered?
Well, the behavioral work we're doing right now, I think, is really, really important. So if I had unlimited funding, I'd probably, first of all, bring on a bunch of graduate students because we can use, you know, the help to assist with data analysis and video analysis, and that's important. You need the bodies. But also, you know, expand on some of these technologies and deploy for longer periods of time. You know, maybe go back to using autonomous vehicles, which we tested in a couple of areas, to get observations. But yeah, but the research and development is happening for the new technologies, and it's very exciting, you know, to go from nothing to where we are today. I'm excited about what we'll see over the next few years.
Yeah. And finally, you know, I just want to mention, JAWS sort of gave white sharks a really bad name, right? And and they're not out there intently wanting to attack humans. I mean, people think that way, but it's really mistaken identity, right? They're not looking. We're not on the menu, let's say.
No, we're not a dietary item for white sharks. You know, the species would not have survived for 400 million years if we were. But our activities now overlap with this, you know, natural ecosystem that includes, you know, top predator feeding on a mesopredator in shallow water. And that is, you know, that's where it gets complicated.
Greg Scomo's biologist, shark expert at the Massachusetts Department of Marine Fisheries. We'll post a link with more information about his research at our website, capeandislands.org. Greg, always good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Mindy. Great to be here.
Coming up after break, a new tagging technique for sea turtles and the start of the cold, stunned sea turtle season. You're listening to The Point. Each year, hundreds of cold-stunned sea turtles wash up on Cape Cod beaches. Some of those turtles are critically endangered species, like the Kemp's Ridley or the threatened loggerhead species. Thanks to efforts of volunteers and staff at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, most turtles are rescued and sent to the New England Aquarium for rehabilitation and eventual release. Last year, several rescued loggerhead turtles became the first to be outfitted with surgically implanted acoustic tags. Joining us to talk about this new tag procedure and what researchers hope to learn from those tagged animals is Kara Dodd. She's a research scientist at the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium. Kara, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mindy.
So explain this phenomenon first of cold stunned turtles and why it happens so frequently to turtles in our waters.
It's really, in our area, it's basically the geography of the Cape acts as a natural trap. So turtles that are swimming here, feeding during the warm summer months, start to migrate south, and they're basically the Cape is in the way, and so they can't make that migration.
And so what's happening to them? The water's getting colder, and they're getting colder, and then what, they just can't move, wash up on the beach?
That's right. So sea turtles are ectotherms, so they take on the temperature of their surrounding environment. So when the water temperatures start to dip basically below around 50 degrees or below 50 degrees Fahrenheit, the turtles will take on that temperature, and they become torpid and listless. They're unable to dive and swim normally, and they end up washing onto beaches with onshore winds during storms.
Hmm. What species of turtle are most commonly found cold stunned in our region?
The most common turtle found during these cold stunning events by far is the Kemp's Ridley. Over 80% of the cold stunned turtles we see here are the critically endangered Kemp's Ridley.
Are smaller turtles more susceptible to becoming cold stunned than the larger ones, or is it equal?
So any of the hard shell turtle species are susceptible to cold stunning, but the turtles that wash up first are the smaller ones because they're unable to basically tolerate the water temperature, those cold water temperatures. And they wash up first. And then as the season progresses, the larger turtles, like the loggerheads, will start washing up.
Last spring, you and colleagues at the New England Aquarium surgically implanted an acoustic tag in loggerhead turtles that were being rehabilitated after being found cold stunned. This was the first time tags had been surgically implanted, right, in sea turtles. Before this, how were you tagging turtles before this new technique?
Yeah, Mindy, that's correct. This was a first. The acoustic implants was a first. Before that, we've really mostly relied on satellite telemetry to do post-release monitoring of our rehabilitated sea turtles. which is really effective, but you're sacrificing cost and longevity with those tags. So those tags cost thousands of dollars. Generally, with the turtles that we work with, which are fast-growing young sea turtles, they like to shed tags really quickly. So you're paying thousands of dollars for a tag that often doesn't last more than 4 to 6 months.
Wow. So what was the motivation then to surgically implant the tags, and how are these tags different from the satellite tags?
So these are acoustic tags. Greg mentioned acoustic tagging earlier as kind of the bread and butter of the white shark work. And we haven't really worked with these tags before, but we knew these tags are long-lasting, so they can, depending on the tag model, it can be 3 to 10 years of battery life. And these tags are quite small so that we can surgically implant them. So I would say the tags we put in these loggerheads were about the size or a little bit smaller than a AA battery.
Oh.
And they're also, as I mentioned, are quite a bit less expensive. And so we're able to tag a larger number of animals for the same cost.
Yeah. And where do you put the tag? Is it the same spot in all the turtles?
So we've only done 4 so far. But those 4, we implanted the tag. It's like right above the turtle's hip. And it's just under the skin. So it should not be able to migrate into any other part of the turtle. That's obviously very important.
And why did you choose loggerheads?
We chose loggerheads because they're bigger, and so they can tolerate a larger tag, but also because they're threatened versus endangered, and this is considered a pilot study. So we've been given permission to try this as a pilot study, so we thought we should start with a threatened species before we move on to, you know, endangered or critically endangered species like the Kemp's Ridley.
Yeah, and is there, I would imagine there's all kinds of laws around that too, right? If critically endangered, it would be a little bit harder to do than threatened, right?
Right. Acoustic tags, I should mention, have been used with sea turtles, but only externally up to this point. We started talking about this, I would say, in 2018. And then we applied for permission to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who covers all of our activities with rehabilitated sea turtles. And it took about a little over a year to get permission to try this pilot study.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how do you collect the data from the tags, and what kinds of information are you getting about the turtles?
So this is a first. So we are relying on the acoustic receiver array that Greg mentioned earlier with the white shark. So actually, Greg's receivers, or I should say Atlantic White Shark Conservancies, have detected a number of our acoustic tags. But we also have an array of acoustic receivers we put out in Nantucket Sound. And so we pulled those in November and downloaded them. And 3 out of the 4 loggerheads that we had implanted the tags in were detected almost 100 times.
Wow. So what's the range of the acoustic buoys that can collect the data from the tags?
Oh, gosh, the range question. So it really depends on the local environmental conditions. And so it can be, in ideal conditions, I think it can be about 700 meters. But, you know, during that big storm we just had in October, it would probably be 0 meters. So it just really depends on what's going on at the time at that location.
Yeah. So what kind of information are you hoping to learn with these tags? What are you hoping to find out?
So the reason we were really excited about using this technique is that we lack long-term data about these rehabilitated turtles. And one of the questions in the conservation community is whether or not it's even worth rehabilitating these turtles. Do they survive? Do they reintegrate into the wild population? You know, and we haven't had the types of tags that could answer those questions. And so we're really hoping to collect multi-year data on these animals that hopefully shows that not only are they surviving, but they're actually showing up in places where we would expect them to be. You know, with the 10-year tags, we're hoping to maybe capture them moving into breeding areas and things like that.
What do we know, if anything, about the long-term health of rehabilitated and released sea turtles?
I mean, we have very limited knowledge. For these sea turtles to be seen again, they would have to either be nesting, or they would have to strand or be captured in an in-water project. And those things are relatively rare. Nesting beaches don't have people out there looking at every turtle. So they could be nesting, but nobody sees them. And so the great thing about the receiver array is that it's out, all throughout, Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, collecting data on these tagged turtles. And so we don't need a human there to intercept that turtle and tell us, oh, that turtle's alive and it's doing well.
Are all cold stunned sea turtles identifiable? I mean, do you find them, stranding multiple times, same turtle?
I'm glad that I talked to the folks in our rehab center before today, because they actually said we did get a restrand from 2020 this year. So we've had almost 200 turtles come through our hospital, and one of them was a restrand from 2020, but that's relatively infrequent for us. I think over all the years we've been rehabbing turtles, we've only had maybe 8 or 9 restrands here. So it's relatively infrequent.
I say, so that's good news, right?
Yeah, it's good news. And the way they can detect that with these small turtles is we put a microchip in all of them, so we can figure out who's who with the the pit tag scanner.
And what are the sea turtle species that we see in our waters? We mentioned loggerheads and Kemp Ridley.
Yep. So there are four species that are regular visitors here. The one that's probably seen most commonly is the leatherback sea turtle, and they're hard to miss. They're big. They're black. Yeah, they can be over 1,000 pounds, and they do spend more time at the surface than the other species, so they're seen most frequently. The loggerhead turtle is probably the next most commonly seen. Kemp's Ridley, which are really hard to see. I've only seen a handful at sea my whole career, and I'm always looking for sea turtles every time I'm on the water. And then the green sea turtle.
Mm-hmm. So they're small. The Kemp Ridleys are small.
Well, the life stage we see here is very small. So Kemp's Ridleys we see here are generally the size of a small dinner plate, and they're gray. They basically match the color of the water around here. Yeah. Green turtles are a little bit more bright, but they are also very small, the ones we see here. And then the loggerheads show up well because they have sort of a bright orangey-red shell.
Mm-hmm. Sea turtles, like many marine animals, are, of course, difficult to study. What are some of the questions researchers still have about sea turtles in general that you'd like to answer? I know you're tagging the loggerheads, but in general, what are some of the questions?
I mean, we're still learning some of the basics also of the life history of these animals. I mean, a lot of the studies that have been done on sea turtles have been focused almost exclusively on nesting females because they're the easiest component of the population to access. They climb up onto a nesting beach, the researchers are there waiting to intercept them, and they can put tags and devices on them. But males, we know very little about because they never, once their baby turtles crawl into the ocean, they're never seen again, really, unless you capture them at sea. Or they strand dead. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the younger life stages are difficult to access.
And is there a way for the public to check out the latest location of tagged turtles in your research? Do you have something like that, you know, app
we,
that...
We don't have a live map right now. So that's the thing about the acoustic tags that's, I guess, a little less exciting for the public is that it's not real-time data. So you're not getting those nice tracking maps where you get the turtle surfaces and you get a new location. The acoustic tags is sort of a delayed gratification situation where we have to wait for the data. But we do have one turtle we're tracking live right now, Glossy Ibis, and that turtle's right off Virginia Beach now. That turtle does have an implanted acoustic tag as well.
Oh, nice. All right, let's talk to George, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, George.
Hi. I wonder if you could talk about all of the turtles who don't get washed up on shore when they get cold. Is it that they've gone somewhere, found a layer of water where it's warmer? Or is it sort of semi-hibernation? Their temperature goes down so much, their metabolic rate goes down, and they're fine? Essentially, that's my question.
Okay. Okay, thanks, George.
Thank you.
Sure. I mean, I wish I had the answer to that question, George. I think turtles probably do become cold stunned in other parts of Massachusetts waters, but because we don't have that nice natural hook to catch them as they wash ashore, there are probably quite a few cold stunned turtles that just wash away, that never actually show up on any beaches. Unfortunately, those turtles, if they do not wash up in a timely manner, that those turtles will die.
Yeah. What should people do if they find a cold stunned turtle on a beach? You're walking along and you see this turtle.
A timely question, Mindy. Yes. So the thing to do if you find a cold stunned sea turtle, and they can be found outside of Cape Cod Bay beaches. Sometimes they're found on the Vineyard and other places. The thing to do is to move that turtle above the high tide line. Be careful when you pick it up. Don't pick it up by the flippers or the head. Move them carefully above the high tide line. Find some seagrass or wrack or whatever you can find to kind of cover them up and keep the wind chill off. And then call Mass Audubon. Do not try to transport that turtle yourself. Mm-hmm. They have very specific ways they do that. And of course, if you're not authorized to have an endangered species in your vehicle, you don't want to be doing that.
Right.
So make sure you call Mass Audubon. I don't have that hotline off the top of my head.
We'll put a link with that. And another thing to note, too, is sometimes you will look at a cold stunned turtle and you go, that turtle's dead. And it may not be. And probably in a lot of cases, it's not, right?
Absolutely. We've had turtles come into our hospital that have, like, less than 2 heartbeats per minute. And a turtle, these turtles normally have 30 to 40 heartbeats per minute. So they can seem like they're dead, but they can come back to life. They're turtles.
So how intensive is the rehabilitation process for the cold stunned turtles?
Very. So these turtles, especially as the season progresses, will come in sort of sicker and sicker. You think about it, they've been in cold water for a longer period of time. And so these turtles are suffering from all sorts of things. It can be, severe pneumonias. It can be fractures from washing up on the beach and rough surf. And so these turtles are really sick. And so they'll take anywhere from 3 to 8 months of pretty intensive rehabilitation until they're ready to be released back into the wild.
So the turtles that get sent to you pretty much spend the entire winter at the aquarium, right?
Some of them do. So what's the phenomenon that's happened here in Massachusetts is that the number of strandings has exceeded our hospital capacity. So since, I would say, it used to be about 80 or so average turtles coming in per year, we now get over 400 on average turtles per year. And so what happens is we sort of act as a triage center at the beginning of the season. We get turtles in, we stabilize them, and the ones that are stabilized then get moved to other partner facilities throughout the country. I mean, these turtles are moving to Mississippi, the Carolinas, Florida, Pittsburgh, all over the country. And then at some point, some of the turtles we have will stay with us for the entire rehabilitation process.
So you used to see 80, now you're seeing 400. Is it more turtles are stranding, or are we just finding more turtles? Or
more
do we
turtles
know?
Are stranding. More turtles are stranding. I mean, there's been consistent volunteer coverage through Audubon for decades. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that we're having more volunteers on the beach and better coverage. It's been very well covered for decades. It's that there are more turtles washing up.
Do we know why?
I mean, very likely that the habitat is becoming a little more turtle friendly. You know, mm-hmm. the waters are getting warmer. They're staying warmer longer. That's probably plays a role in it. You know, some of these populations are recovering a bit. So Kemp's Ridley is actually, we're on a nice 15% increase per year recovery trajectory up until 2010. Now it's a little bit fluctuating, but, you know, so maybe more turtles in the population, more turtles coming up here, staying longer. I think it's all sort of coming together.
Yeah. As we mentioned earlier, the Kemp's Ridley is a critically endangered species and the loggerhead is a threatened species. What are the biggest threats to sea turtles?
One of the biggest threats to sea turtle species is bycatch and fishing gear. That one is particularly problematic for leatherback sea turtles and is probably driving the global decline of that species. Loggerheads as well. And then also, you know, loss of nesting beach habitat is a big problem and will only get worse with climate change. So that's a big one as well. And then in certain areas, turtles are still hunted and harvested, and eggs are collected.
Mm. So you do run out of space then for rehabilitating turtles. Do you ever run out of like places to send them? I mean, sometimes at Mass Audubon, they've got them all over the place on the floors waiting to,
yes.
you know, be brought.
It gets tricky on those days where hundreds of turtles are coming in over a couple day period. And so we have to move them quickly. But, you know, generally we have enough partner facilities and we have this great group called Turtles Fly 2, and NOAA Fisheries helps with that as well. But it's a network of volunteer pilots that fly these turtles as volunteers all over the country to these other facilities.
Wow.
So
and
we're so grateful for them.
Yeah. And so what's the process when you get the turtle, you first get the turtle and they look dead? How do you triage a turtle? I mean, how do you know, okay, this one, he needs help right away, and maybe this one can go over here and just thaw out? I mean,
well, every turtle that comes in gets a full workup by our veterinary staff. And so, you know, the turtles that are in the worst shape are the ones that immediately get brought into the, you know, the exam room and get fluids and get, you know, whatever they need to kind of get them going again.
Mm-hmm.
And other turtles are, you know, not as in bad of shape. So they are set aside and wait their turn.
Yeah. And so when you say the ones that are in bad shape, can you see that with your eyes? I mean, do you see like, oh, he's got a broken shell, or there's some kind of trauma that you can see?
Yeah. It's more like the heart rate and looking at things like that.
Yeah. And then what got you interested in turtles? Is that something why turtles?
Why turtles? I've always been fascinated by turtles, particularly turtles in cold water. So New England, you know, I grew up, you know, not ever seeing a sea turtle, but my dad was a lobsterman in the 60s. And he actually got a leatherback entangled in his lobster pot lines. And so then it was a big story. They didn't think the turtle was a tropical stray, and they brought it into, I grew up in Scituate, and they brought the turtle back to the dock in Scituate and had it in a lobster pound. And they called around to all the, you know, Woods Hole Oceanographic. The Boston Aquarium at the time wasn't even built. And nobody knew what to do with this turtle. They ended up having someone bring it all the way out to the Gulf Stream and release it.
Wow.
And so I grew up with this story about this like huge, you know, and of course, I'm sure they told me it was like 2 tons, and, you know, it was sort of a legend. And so that got me kind of fascinated about these, you know, particularly the leatherback turtle up here in New England.
Another one who started with that fascination as a kid.
Yep,
right? We want to
yep.
encourage those kids to follow their fascinations. Kara Dodge is a research scientist at the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life at the New England Aquarium. We'll post links with more information about her research and at our website, Cape and Island. We'll also put up that number for Mass Audubon if you find a stranded turtle. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.